it really starts in how we think about everything. So about the climate, about the world, about us, about actually also our place as people in a social system.
I think we noticed in the pandemic that we can live much less, and what we were missing most, I think, were the possibility to meet other people. No? So the importance of community. And this is for free. Community is for free. Yeah.
We don't have time to wait until every political party is able to win elections by climate action. Because until this is reached, I don't want to know what happens then.
Inside Impact.
Der Podcast mit Wirkung. Hi and welcome back to Inside Impact. My name is Martin.
And I am Susan. Hello also from my side to this new episode of our series Social Entrepreneurship Meets Sustainability. For those of you who are new here, this current series is a podcast cooperation of the Social Entrepreneurship Center and the Competence Center for Sustainability, Transformation and Responsibility here at VU Vienna.
Today, we are happy to again welcome two exciting guests to our show. Giuseppe Del Mestri is Professor of Change Management here at VU Vienna, co-founder of Scientists for Future, and is also active for Extinction Rebellion. Together with Daniel Glatzer from Fridays for Future, he discusses the importance of grassroots movements for sustainable development.
In addition, they will unveil how climate movements can be organized and talk about their takes on what is needed for adequate climate action. So let's actually jump right into it.
Enjoy!
So hello, Daniel and Giuseppe. Welcome to our podcast Inside Impact, and thank you for being here today. How are you?
Right now, quite good, actually. I enjoy that the situation with the virus is getting a bit more relaxed now.
Yeah, also I'm well. Came by bike, and I have a feeling of being in Italy at the seaside with this temperature. So I feel very positive.
That's great news, actually. But yeah, I also feel energized by the summery warm days. So can you give us a short introduction to both of you, to our listeners? What are you doing? And where do you come from?
What am I doing? That's a big question, actually. Here I am in this podcast as a member of Fridays for Future, of course. But otherwise, actually, I like to, for example, to draw, to write, to do this kind of art-like things. And what I'm engaging myself with in terms of main occupations is studying. And that is two studies. One is Tibetology, so philosophy and languages of Tibet and South Asia. And the second is psychology, and I kind of look for the connections there, which are really interesting. Yeah. What about you?
Yeah, I'm a professor of change management development, head of the institute here at VU, but I'm also here, I think, as a co-founder of the movement organization Scientists for Future, and a first soldier of Extinction Rebellion, where I had some experiences, so I can talk about it later on. Yeah, and
then maybe I should also say after your description something what I do at Fridays, and that is mainly internal group processes, strategy processes, organizational structure, but also advocacy in politics, especially with the climate ministry. So, and citizen assemblies, which is also a big topic just now for us.
Yeah, yeah. And that's great. Yes, I'm at Extinction Rebellion. I just participated at some actions, and I'm trying to help in defining the handbook, organizational handbook, to support the structuration of the movement a bit. Yeah.
Sounds really interesting.
I have to learn a lot because the kind of anarchic form movements are very different than any other forms of organization that I was used to. I thought that the universities are anarchic organization, but in comparison to it, they are really structured and formal, and movements are more magmatic and require other organizational principle than the usual ones.
I would be really interesting if I may be so bold to hear some thoughts of yours maybe not now, but at some point on that topic.
Of course.
Thank you.
Sure, yeah.
No, I want to open the floor, actually, because I think as you're a professor also that engages in change management, which has obviously also a lot of to do with structures and processes of organizations, what is then different from social movements or organizations, grassroots organizations, to other types?
Yeah, when I came to VU and I took the responsibility for this change management institute, I tried to frame change management in a bit different way than is usually framed. Yeah? Because change management is usually considered as a technique for manager to overcome change resistance by subordinates. Yeah, so it's a more kind of partly manipulation technique. Yeah, but not only. You know, there are also some interesting insights about what works and what does not work in change processes. But there is also a broad literature on social movement organization, partial organizations, yeah, which would be the difference between formal organization, which have all characteristics, so membership, rules, hierarchies, rules, and so on, in comparison to partial organization like social movement, who don't have all of these characteristics. Yeah. For instance, in Extinction Rebellion, there is no membership list. Yeah, mm-hmm. And so everybody who says, I am Extinction Rebellion, is member. Mm-hmm. So there's a big difference between formal organization, also mm-hmm. also associations. And therefore, they don't organize as associations. Yeah. And everybody who is following the 10 principles is Extinction Rebellion, which is a big difference. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hierarchy is a word which is not accepted there. They use coordination, synonymous, and we coordinate. So the big issue is to come to decisions. So efficiency is not at the center. So decisions are mm-hmm. taken after involvement of many, many people. Mm-hmm. Takes long, yeah, which is the advantage of democracy. But also could be the disadvantage and some resistance to the creation of some formality. Mm-hmm. But that's it. Yeah. So important is that the movement remains authentic. Yeah. So the people who are there really burn for the issue and not follow their personal agendas of visibility or what else, which is not mm-hmm. the case, I think. And yeah, and things go on. Yeah, and the movement grows. How is it in Fridays for the Future? Do you have a similar situation or it's more structured? Or?
Actually, it's a similar situation. So, and we kind of work on it all the time because it like new challenges. Whenever we solve one thing, then another is coming up. That's kind of the feeling in terms of the structure. But it's very similar in that we also don't have a formal hierarchy. We also use coordinations, which is the difference being that coordination does not imply power to make decisions, but like a responsibility to provide room for a group to reach decisions. And then we have different levels. There's like, how do you call it, working groups. And then there is clusters of working groups, and then there's the plenary. And depending on the size of the decision, they can be taken with more or less people, so which provides some sort of flexibility, but also the inclusiveness. But then we kind of have the challenge to not let it drift away too much, like many people doing like what they really like to do, which is a value. But if it goes in too many different directions, it's also a challenge. So that's kind of the balance that we try to maintain. Mm-hmm. And in terms of hierarchy, after the first time when I engaged with looking at organizational structure in Fridays, at some point we reached the insight that it doesn't make sense to ignore hierarchy because it just happens among people. But it's better for us to look into it and to find a way to make it inclusive. So if people engage really a lot at Fridays and know many things, then of course there's some kind of hierarchy in comparison to someone who just joined. But then the question is how to deal with it in a way that makes it still inclusive and alive and authentic, as you described.
Did you come up with a solution already to that?
Mainly what we think about now is culture, actually, and how this role is understood and how the position is understood. And I think you also mentioned that the point is not to have a have a show for people who want to be visible and to have their own agendas, but then to have like the common aim in front. So our solution to it currently is, on the one hand, having a coordination rule, which does not imply that one is able to impose decisions on others. And the other is to have a culture where it's a value to use the potential that's there in all the people, and that necessarily implies not imposing and having this kind of humbleness to see that others also have good ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had a look at the structure of Extinction Rebellion, UK, you know, which is bigger and started earlier, so some processes and problem of formalization happened earlier, and they have a structure of circles, which circles, spokespeople of circles build say more central circles. I don't say higher circle, because higher reminds of hierarchy, so more central circle where coordination takes place. And it seems that more central circles are able to take decision because they have spokesperson of broader circles, so that everybody is involved in the decision in some way. It works and doesn't work, but this could be also a solution. What I found in other kind of organization with similar issues is that oftentimes it's very good to have a double coordination role, because people are not paid, so and sometimes it's a lot of work, so there is always somebody who is responsible then, and people also want that decision are taken, because and importance the decision are legitimate, this would be great. Otherwise, as you said, leadership, formal leadership always emerges, and then power is exerted. It's sometimes the formality allows for power not to emerge so directly. If you say, no, we don't have form, we don't have rules. Yeah, also, small family firms don't have rules, but have strong power. Napoleon said, we should not make a constitution as small as we can, because so we can maintain more power. So this fight against formality can have drawbacks in terms of democracy.
Already very interesting discussion that we have here. And now, as we are actually talking about, or in this whole series of episodes in this podcast, we are talking about sustainability mainly, or sustainable development. And we various times now use the word change. I want to hear your opinion on what change is maybe needed, what role change has to achieve sustainable future, or social ecological transformation, whichever term you might prefer, and maybe also explain a bit.
I think change is a word which has strong positive connotation, also always have positive connotation, maybe too positive and too mainstream positive connotation. Maybe the right word would be transformation, to say exactly what we need to. Otherwise, we fall in denial, denial of what is really required. And if I can elaborate a bit on this, because I studied these issues, we have different forms of denial. The obvious one are in terms of climate crisis. There is no climate crisis. Yeah, this is the denial of the facts. Yeah. Then you have denial of the causes. This is the second form. So the humans are not responsible for it. So it's natural. So and we saw this in the Republican Party in the US very clearly, to these forms of denial. But then we have a more sophisticated or more subtle forms of denial, with the denial of consequences, which we see more in Europe. Or maybe even now in the US with a new president. Because what is the consequence? Okay. There is a climate crisis, we are responsible, and what are the consequences? And you see denial of consequences taking different discursive forms, like discourses of climate delay, I would call them, not only me, all the other colleagues call them. So different kind of discourses to say, okay, but we don't have to change completely. Yeah? So the denial of consequences, we don't need a transformation. Technology will solve it. Yeah? Or consumer will solve it. Yeah, it's enough that you buy vegan stuff. Yeah, I eat personally vegan, but nevertheless, I don't think that only by a consumption you can save the world. Yeah, we can maybe elaborate later more on this, but this is a central aspect. Not the denial of consequences in this climate delaying discourses that are spreading around and are very dangerous.
And this is actually something that we come across a lot. This kind of feeling that people, especially politicians, unfortunately, seem to not really let it touch them what is actually happening. So they might talk about it, they might like play it down, and then, but I also feel they, like, there's a difference between cognitively understanding and like truly understanding, I would say. And this true understanding, which is the only basis for changing one's actions, is often not there. And to some point I understand it, because there something I think comes into play that it's called cognitive dissonance, which basically means that there's two contradicting perceptions in one's mind. One is there's a climate crisis and everything has to change. The other is I'm comfortable, this seems frightening, I don't want to. And how to resolve this conflict? And often the easy route is taken, which is just to kind of push it away, to say, well, it's not that bad. And then I'm saved this kind of internal struggle. But I think what is really important now, and that comes also back to the question of what change could be and has to be. And I think it really starts in how we think about everything. So about the climate, about the world, about us, about actually also our place as people in a social system. I mean, it's easy for me to talk about the climate crisis and point out its urgency because I do something against it. So I don't have this kind of internal struggle. But many people, I think, don't think that they are in a position to really do anything. And that makes it really difficult to deal with it. Because if I accept this crisis and I say, well, I'm not able to do anything, then it's like, I think it's a terrible feeling. And many people wouldn't want that, which is understandable. So I would say the change that is required starts with people acknowledging what potential for action they have and what potential for achieving change they have and what power they have actually. And then being able to think about how it could be differently and what really is the need of us as people and how to find a way where we can look this crisis in the eye because we know that we can do something about it and we are in contact with each other and we are in contact with ourselves and know what we need and what the way could be. So this kind of acknowledgement of one's own power and then being able to listen to oneself and to listen to others, I think is like where this change can emerge from. Because it does have to span across all kinds of what makes up our life. So economy, of course, but also what we regard as a meaningful and as a successful life, and then how we want to relate to others, how we want to live. I could go on endlessly, I think. And because it is such a big transformation, I think it's really required to understand that everyone is able to actively shape it.
And Daniel is pointing to a central issue in this transformation. So the need to overcome this crisis of imagination that we are confronting. So that we have very clearly, very directly our world. Here, it's a carbon-based world. And especially if you are in these countries, like Austria, it has lots of advantages. Yeah? Mm-hmm. So what? It's difficult for us to imagine a different world where we don't have these advantages of a very cheap but very polluting source of energy. Yeah, and then you mentioned also this discourse of surrender, yeah, mm-hmm. which is one of the climate delaying discourses. Mm-hmm. We cannot do anything. Mm-hmm. It's too late. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm. So what matters? Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. This is one of the discourses which is coming out. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Some of these surrender discourses, or considered auch doomist discourses, have some paradoxically effect of motivation. There was a lot of discussion and on Jem Bendel's deep adaptation framework. I don't know if you publish online a paper who was downloaded thousands and thousands of times. And the main idea was there is no research in management under the assumption that we cannot do it. Yeah. And mm-hmm. she says, if we cannot do it because it's too late, what should we do? Yeah. Mm-hmm. This was more an academic idea. Yeah. and then lots of pushbacks. Yeah. But he was very prominent in Extinction Rebellion, which are for sure very motivated to act as a movement. So there is this paradox. Yeah? So somebody saying it's more probable that we will fail, that our civilization will collapse. And this, instead of leading to surrender, leads to more motivation in many people. Mm. Yeah? So, but there is also in psychological literature, there is still a debate. Yeah. So imagining the collapse motivates us or not. Yeah. So this is an interesting question. Yeah.
Actually, at Fridays for Future, we have one of our principles is that we communicate in a positive way, like also in a positive way. Of course, it's very central to us to point out the urgency of it and to really say, well, it is there and we have to act. But then also to point out that it can be a change for the better. And the really big question is, our paradigms and the system of how we relate to the world and how we view our place in the world. And I think that many things can provide it, and culture and religion and science, and it can like come from many different places. But I think now we have one which leads us to perform actions that are actually very destructive. Not like always, but statistically probably in the majority of cases when we talk about exploiting the planet and all of that. And I think what is really important now is to change this paradigm system. And obviously, I think in the past, often these kind of paradigm systems were supported by religion. And this kind of place in the world was provided by a religious system. And now we have the scientific system, which also has its underlying assumptions, which are also part of a social process. So I would say that this is not necessarily a conflict. We just have to find a way to communally and based on reasoning and observation, find a paradigm system which is in accordance with the workings of the world and the workings of ourselves. And so I think we can now, based on science and culture, provide something, and we have to provide something and find something that in the past was provided by religions, in fact. And now we can have it based on science. So I think I wouldn't see a contradiction there.
My thoughts are similar. I think we need a new narrative. I think each system is sustained by some kind of narrative which legitimizes the system. Yeah. So we have the Roman Empire was legitimated by myth. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then we had religion legitimated what came after the Roman Empire. Then we had the Enlightenment, which was mainly based on a value of positive science. Yeah. Mm-hmm. In which also economics, as which is probably the central science in our society, since and these positive premises are such that economics, which is a social science, is framed as a natural science, which gives more legitimacy because the whole narrative from the Enlightenment is based on natural sciences. Yeah, so to overcome the dark ages of superstition. Yeah? So economics framed as such is more legitimate because the main narrative that we have is a positive narrative. Yeah.
Due to our economic system mainly, and also history, I would argue, like path dependency, whatever you might call it, competition is something that maybe even in our DNA, we have it learned so well also. I think to overcome competition is a key issue to actually achieve social ecological transformation. But how to? And maybe you have some insights from your organizations.
Since you asked how to overcome this, I mean, with Fridays, our main strategy for achieving change is protests, obviously. And that has the aim of making something visible and like making it heard and bringing it into consciousness and again until it has to be understood and also kind of has the time to sink in and really change behavior. So that's like our hope in protesting, actually, to achieve a change in the common understanding of our situation. And I think in terms of how to change the competitive framework, I would obviously then propose a similar approach. So there are many findings that actually support that humans are cooperative beings, that's kind of how we got to kind of ruling the world evolutionary, because we are like probably among the best cooperators in the world, and that's our strength. So that's how we got there, and all kinds of psychological studies as well. And I would say one has to make this visible again and again and again and again, probably, and support it, and from different perspectives and from different angles, and to show that it really is like this. And then the basic assumptions could maybe change over time, and then the structures could change, and then this kind of circle where structure supports assumptions and assumptions form structure can shift from a competitive and more destructive one to a more cooperative one. But that obviously touches many things that are very, very deep in our psychology. For example, greed and pride in the way of, like, I'm the greatest and I have to get this confirmed all the time, which is really exhausting, by the way.
Narcissism.
Yeah, narcissism. Thank you. And I think also there it's important to see that it doesn't have to be that way, that we are not by nature defined by emotions such as greed and pride and anger. And that's not our nature to be egoistic. I think this is an insight. If we can have that in a society, then my hope would be that everything else changes for the better.
On this, in order to start a bit more controversial, so mm-hmm. maybe we are not always have always the same opinion.
Please.
There are two aspects. One aspect is the how to effectively protest, yeah, mm-hmm. and the other aspect will be which kind of narrative or which kind of future we can prefigure, yeah. Mm-hmm. But let me start from the first mm-hmm. to be controversial. I noticed in the movement in Vienna mm-hmm. there was recently some debate in some social media that they mm-hmm. were observing about the fact that the Fridays for Future is becoming too gentle mm. and not supporting the more radical forms of protest. Yeah, mm. because there is also literature mm. that civil disobedience. Mm. Yeah, so breaking some rules, like in the U.S. when people of color broke the rule mm. and sit on buses where they could not. Yeah, so mm. this kind of breaking rules. And mm-hmm. here is mainly doing in the Gelände and the Extinction Rebellions and others. This kind of protests, if they are non-violent, are more effective than simply going on the streets, manifestations, like something like that. Yeah. If the Fridays for Future would join this civil disobedience protest, it would create much more pressure on society to change. Yeah, mm-hmm. because nowadays we see there are lots of rallies in the streets. You mm-hmm. have the Fridays, but you have also the Corona Leugner, mm-hmm. the Corona mm-hmm. deniers. Yeah, mm-hmm. and the effect is relative. Yeah. Maybe it's only just because we had the pandemic. I think the Friday, because they started all of this without mm. Fridays for Future, mm. Greta, and the 100,000 of people or millions of people went to the streets, nothing would have changed, yeah. At least the awareness. Yeah. But now it's not the time to get more radical, given that the normality is evil. Yeah, the normality is radical, and the radical is normal, should be normal.
Yeah, so that's like XR, I hear that strongly. And I also value this a lot. And the question of civil disobedience has been one that like accompanied us from the moment Fridays began, actually. And in fact, it did begin with civil disobedience. School strikes is a way of civil disobedience, actually.
Indeed, yes.
Yeah. And this is also still like the core of what we do, even though I have to admit that I would really wish for more presence and more contact in and with schools and school children. So obviously one isn't a school child forever, and we are also growing older. So this is obviously a challenge to keep this root in that way. But then also, obviously, this is also a debate within Fridays, but I have to say that, and also stress that, Fridays has become as big as it is because we did what we did. And that means having also a high degree of inclusiveness and really be able to touch every circle in society. And I once saw this description of how change might happen, and it basically looks like a Gauss curve. It's a curve which looks a bit like a hill, which is symmetrical. So there's the top in the middle, and then it goes down to left and right. And if it goes from left to right, like right, the top end would be very progressive, and the other end would be the people that are never reached at all, regardless of what one does. And in the middle are most people. This is like something, something. So a bit progressive, a bit conservative. In Austria, maybe a bit more conservative. and one goes from top to like from left to right, or from right to left, or from front to back. Let's call it front to back, because progressive implies front. And I think it needs to go up to a certain stage where a critical mass of people is reached. And I think it takes both. It takes the avant-garde, which is really progressive and really radical. And then it takes also something which can access a broad range of people. For example, in terms of Lobau, the street project, which where the government in Vienna and in Austria want to build a highway through, basically tunneling through a protected natural area. And there, this is like the spark of our debate in terms of civil disobedience just now, where we actually consider maybe using it if it becomes necessary. Mm-hmm. But also in the media, it's oftentimes compared to Hainburg, which was like the famous protests, I think, how many years ago? 30? Where also the Green Party was born in Vienna, and like the start of the environment. Or actually, I don't like the word environment, because it implies this separation. We are here, environment is there, but nature protection, and also world protection, maybe, because this would include us as well, movements. And there, I think the big tipping point was reached by the protests that were in the field and were like actively through civil disobedience preventing the construction, but also by the huge demonstrations that were happening in Austria and in Vienna, and where everyone went to, basically. So one doesn't work without the other. And I think the strength of Fridays would be in these demonstrations, without which it also wouldn't work. So that's like how I feel about it. Mm-hmm. And becoming too radical, I think there is already Extinction Rebellion, which has this role and fulfills it well and has to fulfill it well. And then I think Fridays can have the role of really reaching everyone. And that this together is, I think, very strong and might contradict each other. So it's, I think, very feasible to have two movements for it.
I agree that there is also lots of radical flank theory, you know, that you need mm-hmm. a radical flank to mm-hmm. legitimate a less radical flank. Yeah, this, we know also this theory. So it was more trying to have some more debate.
Yeah, I really like the impulse.
I really like what you both describe as your ideas being behind an organization that thrives for change, that actually does promote change on streets, actually going out, being loud, being heard. But you then described, for example, that you need to reach a critical mass and then maybe change might occur naturally. Do we have time to wait for a critical mass?
This is, I think, for me, really important to convey that also at Fridays for Future, we direct our demands mainly to the government, actually, and to corporations and to everyone who basically is responsible for emissions. And we are really like allergic to people's bringing this consumption thing and this everyone is responsible and this blah, blah, which basically only means that the structures are not changed. And therefore, I think it needs both. But you're right, I agree with you. We don't have time to wait until every political party is able to win elections by climate action. Because until this is reached, like, I don't want to know what happens then. So what is required now is really, really courage from everyone who has some kind of responsibility. And this is what we demand actually in Fridays. Obviously courage, but also willingness, because that's basically, I think, what lacks the most also, in many political parties. So I would say that it's necessary to have this discourse in society and to change the way we think. And actually, this is from 2011. I read this in the, like, there's this German scientific council, and they published this in 2011. And I have this quote that communities have to reconsider basic values and change the way they think about the problem. And this is like what they wrote back like 10 years ago. And so this is, I think, very much there, but it has to have two sides. And the other side is that action is required now and emission reduction is required now. And these kind of changes, we just don't have time to wait at all, actually. We didn't have time to wait 3 years ago. We didn't have time to wait 10 years ago, really. We might have time to wait 50 years ago, but it was decided to do nothing back then. And now we really, like, every month that passes might mean more deaths in 50 years, in 100 years, in 200 years. So I can nothing but agree with you that we don't have time. But it also needs the perspective of attitude change in a broad society. So it needs both, and it really needs people who have responsibility now to step up, to expose themselves also, and to not go like after every poll and every like what the Kronenzeitung likes best, but really to take responsibility that they are supposed to have, and to step up and be really like, if they claim to lead, then they should do it or step back. Unfortunately, we are not in such a position directly. So therefore, we are in a position and also in a responsibility as social movements, because this is mainly where social innovation comes from, not from established structures, but from social movements. So I think we have this kind of ecological responsibility to really not give in until this action is taken.
I think Hannah Arendt wrote a great book, Die Banalität des Bösens, the banality of evil. Mm-hmm. And I think now we could write the book, the Bösartigkeit der Banalität, or the evil of banality. Yeah, because now more and more people are aware of the banality of this climate delaying discourses that are getting more sophisticated as soon as more people get aware of the crisis. Yeah. So this techno fix, the consumist fix. Yeah. The discourse of a free rider excuse. Yeah. Like, okay, but if I do it, yeah, he will not. So mm-hmm. he will profit. Mm-hmm. So I don't do nothing. Yeah. Yeah. You know, Austria is just 0.5%. I don't know exactly of pollution. So China should start first. Yeah. Mm. And so on, yeah. Mm-hmm. And we are getting more and more fed up with this, yeah. So we are recognizing the evilness of all of this. And I think in the past, the previous generation, I'm reading biographies of grandfathers who fought against the fascism, yeah? And mm-hmm. went on the mountains as partisans. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we are not violent. No? So, but what would happen in 5-6 years if people recognize more and more now that nothing happens and then they are destroying it? And the number of deaths implied in this crisis is much bigger than what happened in the Second World War and all around. Yeah? And so 50 million, 60 million, what's this? That's already 100,000 of people are dying now because of climate crisis. And once people will realize, it could happen that the rebellion will turn violent. I hope not. Yeah, but then it would be framed as the partisanships. Yeah, the problem is that you have under a world where the banality of evil is on power. It's easy. The enemy is visible, also physical. Now the enemy is more in the system. Yeah, and the courage you mentioned. Yeah, the courage that we need in this situation is fundamental. But for sure, we need some discourse. We need some prefiguration of what will be the future world. Yeah. So for instance, showing that this having children playing in the streets instead of cars. Yeah. Yeah. Having less people dying because there are there's too many pollution. I think we noticed in the pandemic that we can live with much less, and which what we were missing most, I think, were the possibility to meet other people. No? So the importance of community. And this is for free. Community is for free. Yeah,
I totally agree what's important in life. And also, I think community, and also since you mentioned the COVID pandemic, this also showed us what is actually possible. I mean, everything was changed from within 1 week, basically, in March 2020. So no one can really credibly say anymore that things are not possible in terms of the climate crisis. No one.
One last question. And this is obviously the most interesting question. You have brought a book with you and you have a recommendation, I think. What are your book recommendations that you have for our listeners?
Yeah, my book recommendation is a book from Rob Hopkins, From What Is to What If, yeah, Unleashing the Power of Imagination to Create the Future We Want. Mm-hmm. And the author is the founder of the Transition Towns movement. Mm-hmm. And I think it's great because it speaks to this idea of creating a new narrative to give the idea how the future could look like. And in different examples, it shows how our cities could be nicer, how our education could be nicer. You mentioned this, how we could have a diet to nourish us instead of making us ill, and all these issues. So it's a really brings hope, yeah, brings hope that the future is possible outside of consumption and highways and tunnels and more of the same is now it's the situation.
That sounds really interesting. Maybe I can buy it at some point and read it. My recommendation, actually, I have like one that is in German, so maybe if I'm allowed, I would also add one in English, so it's two recommendations. So the one in German is by historian Michael Blohm, and it's actually a short essay that he wrote in the context of the Salzburger Festspiele. It's called Das große Welttheater, and he describes basically how our narratives and paradigms and assumptions that we had since hundreds of years ago, and also in the Bible, like at least in the German translation, one finds this, macht euch die Erde untertan. So it means rule over the world and make the world your subordinate, basically. He describes how this, since the last 100 years, just more and more breaks apart because the world just reveals that it doesn't accept it. And the climate crisis proves that, and that now the question of the future is also a question of which kind of narrative we will develop. And if we will be able to develop a narrative that enables us to kind of save our place. The second, just very shortly, is this is English for all the listeners who don't speak German. It's called Humankind by Rutger Bregman, I think Danish historian. And he basically does away with the paradigm of the egoistic and bad human and kind of, it's like popular scientific, but he has lots of evidence and examples of how this is just not true, this assumption that humans are egoistic. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel and Giuseppe, for this wonderful talk. As always, you can find book recommendations and other mentioned sources in the description of this episode.
Inspired by Giuseppe Del Mestri's utopian blog post on the Vienna University of Sustainable Economics and Responsible Business, we will have a closer look at our university's actions with regards to sustainability issues in our very next episode. WU's rector Edeltraud Hanapi-Egger will discuss the role of universities in the discourse, responsibility in teaching and research, as well as measures taken on our campus here.
Until then, as always, you can find further information on our Instagram channel, insideimpact_, and if you want to get in touch with us, you can also send us an email to insideimpact@vu.ac.at. And if you like Inside Impact, feel free to give us a review on your favorite podcast platform and tell your friends about it. See you next week, and all the best from the Inside Impact team.
See you.